Hi, and welcome to the JRB Podcast. I'm Abe Socher, your host and the editor of the Jewish Review of Books. This summer, Oren Kessler won the prestigious Sammy Rohr Prize for Nonfiction for his book Palestine 1936, The Great Revolt and the Roots of the Middle East Conflict. It's a gripping retelling of the Arab Revolt from 1936 to 1939, which draws upon archival documents in English, Hebrew, and Arabic. Kessler claims that this three-year conflict, not the ones before it and not the 1948 War of Independence after, set the essential terms of the Jewish-Arab encounter in the Middle East up till the present moment. Given the extremity of this moment, I spoke with him on August 8th, the fourth day of Av, as Israel and the world awaited the next major salvos from Lebanon and Iran. I thought it'd be a good time, if that's the right word, to talk with him about his book. Oren is a journalist and political analyst based in Tel Aviv, and Palestine 1936 is his first book. I learned a lot from our conversation, and I think you will too. Oren Kessler, welcome. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Abe, for having me.
You've written a terrific, lucid, really gripping history of the Arab Revolt of 36 to 39. It's called Palestine 1936. But before we get to that and its contemporary resonances, we're talking on August 8th, which, if I'm not mistaken, is the fourth day of Av, so leading up to Tisha B'Av. But also, everybody is waiting to see how Iran and Hezbollah respond to the assassinations of Ismail Haniyeh and Fuad Shukr. And I'm talking to you in Tel Aviv, correct?
That's right. That's right. And don't forget Mohammed Deif. Somehow we've already forgotten about
right.
him, but it's only been a couple weeks.
So you're in Tel Aviv. There is perhaps a massive retaliation from Iran coming. How are you doing? And what's the mood in your house, on the street?
Well, thank you for asking. Israelis are certainly some of the most resilient people on the planet, and we're certainly used to abnormal situations. I would say that it feels about 90% normal here. You know, even before these assassinations, of course, the situation was not normal. You can pretend it's normal. You can go to your, you know, corner cafe, but you're sitting under photos of hostages and there are stickers all over the place of people killed, murdered on October 7th. So even before this wave of assassinations, things were very, very far from normal. This is still a country that's mourning, that's in grief. And yet, in a sort of surreal way, the cafes are full, the bars are full, the beaches are full. It's a sort of compartmentalization, I would say. People have perhaps stocked up a bit. We've got our go bags lying by the door just in case. But on the whole, things look relatively normal.
I saw somebody sent this tweet and responses that I think happened this morning. So a Nasrallah account tweeted out in Hebrew, maybe tonight, maybe tomorrow, maybe in a week. And all these Israelis responded, me starting a diet, me about to study for an exam, the cable guy's text message.
Right.
So just riffing on it, which is, you know, both funny and a sign of a little data point for Israeli resilience and humor in the face of danger.
Well, there was another tweet today that was posted by somebody with a watermelon next to their name about how, you know, this the Zionist entity must come to an end. It's lost all legitimacy, et cetera, et cetera. And it was the same kind of response. Israelis were tweeting things like, you know, me when I'm stuck in traffic at the entrance of Tel Aviv, you know, me when I go to the bank or the post office. I'm convinced that the Zionist entity must cease.
Well, on that cheery 9-day note, let's talk about what happened 80 years ago, the story you tell in Palestine 1936, which you say cast the mold for the Jewish-Arab encounter or conflict ever since. So maybe let's begin here. Who was al-Din Qassam?
Yeah, Izz al-Din al-Qassam. Your listeners will probably recognize the name Qassam. Of course, the Hamas armed wing, the Hamas terror wing that conducted the atrocities of October 7th is known as the Qassam Brigades. They're the homemade rockets that Hamas first launched at Israel were Qassam rockets. Qassam was a preacher. He was originally from Syria, from the Latakia area, and he came down to mandate Palestine in the early 20s because he was wanted by the French mandate authorities in Syria for causing trouble, for inciting the populace against the French. He comes down to Haifa, and he is appointed by another man who we shall talk about. That's Grand Mufti Haj Amin al-Husseini. He's appointed to be the imam, the preacher, at a mosque in Haifa. It's still an active mosque. You can visit it. It's called Istiklal Mosque. And he's preaching jihad. He's preaching very often with a sword or a pistol at his side. And he's preaching to the urban Muslim poor of Haifa, which is a real boom town in this period, particularly in the 30s. It becomes kind of the British hub for Palestine. The British build a big port there, and there's a railway terminus, and the Iraq oil pipeline has its terminus there. And he's preaching against the Jews and against the British, who are, of course, governing the Holy Land in this time. And he's preaching things like, you know, the next time the British soldier presents his boot for you to shine, you know, leave the brush in the box and take out a pistol, that sort of thing. And his followers wage a few sporadic intermittent attacks, some of which are deadly, both against Jews and against British servicemen. And at a certain point in late 1935, they kill a Jewish member of the Palestine police by the name of Moshe Rosenfeld. And this was a major mistake, because now they've killed a member of His Majesty's police. And long story short, a manhunt ensues, a gun battle ensues, and Qassam is killed by the British in the forests of what we now call the West Bank, the Northern West Bank, in the sort of Jenin area. And he really becomes the first kind of martyr icon for the Arabs of Palestine. And David Ben-Gurion, who even in this period is the leader of the Yishuv, he's the head of the Jewish agency, the pre-state Jewish community, he recognizes the significance of this moment immediately. And he writes in his diary, "Finally, the Arabs have found a man who's willing to die, to give his life for an idea or for an ideal." And he predicted that hundreds or thousands more would follow in his footsteps. And indeed, just a few months after that, in April 1936, some of Qassam's followers ambush an elderly Jewish poultry merchant, again in that same Nablus, Jenin, Tulkarem area, which is still very much a center of Palestinian militancy and terrorism. They kill two Jews, and these are really the opening shots of the great Arab revolt of 1936-39.
How many Jews are in British Mandate Palestine at that point?
In this period, they're approaching 300,000 in a total population of about a million, a bit more than a million. So they're approaching 30%. And the Jewish population of Mandate Palestine doubles in the first half of the 1930s.
That's why, yeah, how many of those 300,000 are German Jews, or those by extension fleeing Hitler? What's immigration like at that point?
Well, in this period, of course, Hitler comes to power in January 1933 in Germany, but all over Europe there are these anti-Semitic movements on the rise in Poland and Hungary and Romania. And this just has the effect of turbocharging Jewish immigration to Palestine. And so, again, the population doubles in the first half of the 30s. The population of Tel Aviv triples, land sales double. And the Arabs of Palestine are very much perceptive enough to recognize that the face of this land, demographically speaking, is changing very rapidly. And the Jews would be a majority before long if it continued that way.
So how does the revolt begin, the attempt to put an end to this immigration and more generally the Zionist project?
Right. So you've got Qassam's acolytes opening fire on this poultry merchant and his driver on the highway leading from Jenin and Tulkarem. And then a few days after that, there is what the newspapers at the time called the Bloody Day in Jaffa, April 19th, 1936. And it's just multiple terrorist attacks around Jaffa and the kind of border neighborhoods of Jaffa and Tel Aviv, in which, well, I'd have to check my book, but I believe about 20 Jews are killed over 2 days. And really, at this point, it's clear to everyone, to Jew, Arab, and Briton alike, that this is a new phase in the conflict, that this really represents something new under the sun, as it were, in terms of the brewing Jewish-Arab conflict in Palestine.
So sometimes, and when we think about the conflict and massacres and terrorism, we go back to 29, to Hebron. What's different about this? The Hebron massacre, if I'm not mistaken, was, at least at this point in the conflict, worse. And yet, the people at the time and you as a historian now don't think of that as the turning point. What's the difference?
Well, I do think Hebron 1929 was a turning point. 133 Jews were killed over a matter of a few days. And these were a series of very grim and gruesome attacks that really in many ways recalled the gruesome terrorism that we saw on October 7th of last year. But I believe, and I argue in the book, that that's essentially terrorism. It was riots, but it was not a sustained nationalist uprising. It was a few days of very severe, horrifying violence. But the period that I'm writing about in this book is a 3-year period, and really an intifada is what, you know, in the parlance of our times, it's a sustained uprising which of course came with a lot of violence and a lot of bloodshed. There are 500 Jews who were killed by the end of this revolt. These are huge numbers that we wouldn't see until the beginning of this century. And yet there's a political impetus to it as well, and there's a kind of sustained nature to it that hadn't really been seen at all in Palestine beforehand.
And Ben-Gurion, as you say, recognizes very soon, if not right away, that this is something new. How does he react? Or rather, let me not make the question rhetorical. When I was reading your book, I thought of that quote that's often attributed to Churchill, and definitely Rahm Emanuel said it, you know, never let a crisis go to waste. You know, it seems like Ben-Gurion sort of sees the moment. I say a little bit about that.
Yeah, Ben-Gurion was really an expert at turning adversity into advantage. And Ben-Gurion really saw in the Arab revolt a tremendous source of leverage to achieve some of his long-standing aims for the Yishuv. He had a vision of really creating a self-sufficient Jewish polity that could feed itself and employ itself and house itself and defend itself without any help from the Arabs or from the British. And indeed, one of the just massive consequences of this revolt is this is really when the seed of a Jewish army is sown. This is really when the Haganah goes from being a network of glorified night watchmen's units to really the seed of a Jewish army. And it's all thanks to this Arab revolt. Basically, Ben-Gurion turns to the British, the Yishuv turns to the British and pleads with them to be allowed to take part in the kind of security apparatus. And this is something that the British had essentially refused until then. There were some Jews in the Palestine police, but there was nothing on a large scale. And throughout this period, about 15,000 to 30,000, I'd have to check my numbers, but the tens of thousands of Jews enter the Palestine police as what's called Jewish supernumerary police, or notrim in Hebrew. But basically, it's clear to everyone that they're ultimately answering to the Haganah, which is still, it's often forgotten, but it's still illegal in this period. It's technically illegal, but the British kind of turned a blind eye as long as it behaved itself and limited itself to self-defense. And so really, this is a period in which the Jews become a military force, a very significant military force. The Jews grow economically by leaps and bounds. The Arabs wage a boycott, an economic boycott. There's some real resonance to the situation today with the whole Boycott Israel movement. But the sort of Arab leadership announces a complete boycott on the Jewish economy and the British authorities. And it lasts for 6 months. And to a certain extent, even after that, it's even to this day one of the longest general strikes anywhere in the world. But this has a direct effect of bolstering the Jewish economy. So in all of these ways, the Jews come out stronger from this revolt, despite the very painful cost in blood and in many ways in treasure, and the Arabs come out much weaker. And the revolt to crush Zionism really ends up, at the risk of jumping ahead here a bit, it ends up weakening the Arab society massively and much more than the Jews.
And so we've talked about Ben-Gurion and more generally about the Jewish leadership. How about on the Arab side?
Yeah, you can't really talk about this period without talking about the Mufti, the Grand Mufti, Haji Amin al-Husseini, who is appointed in 1920-21 by the British. And moreover, he's appointed by Herbert Samuel, the first high commissioner for Palestine, who was a Jew and a Zionist. And it's in one of the great blunders of in a history of blunders, perhaps the first great blunder in the history of this conflict on the part of the great powers, was the appointment of this 25-year-old, relatively unremarkable member of a prominent Jerusalem family, the Husseinis, who had scant religious credentials, to this extremely important position, which was essentially for life, the Grand Muftiship. And Samuel created something called the Supreme Muslim Council, which he also appointed Amin to head, also essentially for life. And this had tremendous power. This was basically, this council basically took over all of the religious responsibilities and authorities that the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman authorities, had had before the British arrived, were basically transferred over to the Supreme Muslim Council. And so, single-handedly, Herbert Samuel creates this monster, or it turned out to be a monster in the end, of this one man who was vested with tremendous power and turned out to be just an overwhelmingly negative force. I think it's hard to argue otherwise. Certainly, from a Jewish perspective, but equally from an Arab perspective. I mean, it's hard to point to many gains, or any gains really, that Haji Amin's intransigent sort of extremist leadership brought them. And at a certain point in late 1937, it becomes clear to everyone that he's actually pulling the strings of this revolt, and he flees to the Temple Mount, where he suspects the British won't dare pursue him, and he's right, and then he flees the country. Because he's, again, he is, not to suggest he's sending every last gunman to go kill Jews, but he's guiding the revolt along its main lines, and everybody knows it. And so he won't come back to Palestine for another 4 decades or so.
And at what point does he go to Germany?
Right, so he flees Palestine dressed as a Bedouin. Some sources say dressed as a woman, but I believe he was dressed as a Bedouin, and he makes his way to Jaffa Port, and then boards a boat and sets up shop in Lebanon, and just outside of Beirut. And from there, he makes his way to Iraq in 1941. Basically, pretty much everywhere he goes, he makes himself unwelcome. He goes to Iraq and supports a pro-fascist coup there in 1941, which is the immediate precursor to the Farhud of 1941, the pogrom that killed, nobody exactly knows, but hundreds of Jews in Baghdad in 1941. And from there, he makes his way through Tehran, actually, and ends up, and through fascist Italy, and ends up, of course, in Berlin. And he spends most of World War II in Berlin. The photos of the Mufti with Hitler have become iconic at this point, but I think he only met Hitler once. The person he met with at least 3 or 4 times was Himmler. And he had a relationship with Himmler, and Himmler, according to the Mufti's own memoirs in Arabic, Himmler told the Mufti midway through the war that the Germans had already killed 3 million Jews. The Mufti's, his activity during the war, you know, if history had panned out slightly differently, he would have been tried for war crimes, because he was not only leading the Nazi propaganda effort in Arabic, but he was also recruiting soldiers to the Waffen-SS in the Balkans, and moreover, he was doing everything he possibly could to keep a single Jew from being allowed to enter Palestine. So yeah, so that's the Mufti, and it's rather unfortunate, but it has to be said that even after his shenanigans in World War II at the side of Hitler and Himmler, he still remains the head of the Palestinian Arab National Movement. He remains, you know, he makes his way to Cairo after the war, and he remains at the top of the Palestinian National Movement until the debacle of 48, until the defeat and the dispersal of the Palestinians in 48. It's only then that he's kind of tossed into the dustbin of Palestinian history. And you'll notice he's not really mentioned very much. He's not, you know, his name is not mentioned by Palestinians the way Qassam's name is, for example, because he led them to ruin.
Right. Well, one of the things that underlines this revolt from the very beginning is the increase in Jewish immigration. You said the Mufti tried as hard as he could to keep Jews from fleeing Hitler and getting to Palestine. That gets us to the end of your 36 to 39 period, to the White Paper. But let's go back earlier. Before the White Paper, the British first reaction is the Peel Commission. So what happens in the Peel Commission? How does that change in the White Paper? How do we get from one to the other?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when I try to home in on sort of three main central legacies of this period, I think the Peel Commission has to be one of them. This is the first time in which the great power with the most sway over the conflict, and Great Britain in this case, puts a two-state solution on the table and really comes up with this idea of partition, division, dividing the land between the river and the sea, to use a trending phrase right now, to divide that land into two states, including a Jewish state. So this is not merely a Jewish national home as promised by the Balfour Declaration, with that kind of deliberate ambiguity there of what is a Jew, what is a national home. This is a state.
Doesn't need to be a state, Jay.
Right, right. There's a lot of wiggle room there when you say national home. But now, in mid-1937, when the British send this royal commission that's acting in the name of the king, this is the highest level commission of inquiry that the British Empire has, and they come over here and they spend several months here and they speak to dozens of leading Zionists and British administrators, and ultimately they speak to the Mufti and some other leading Arabs after the Mufti calls off his boycott of the commission. And they come up with this dramatic revolutionary proposal, which really in many ways set the template for every subsequent attempt to partition this land up until our present day. This notion of creating two states between the river and the sea remains kind of the preferred template. And there's a raucous debate among the Jews over whether to accept this plan. But the two men who matter most, and it's almost all entirely men in this period, are Ben-Gurion and Chaim Weizmann, the head of the World Zionist Organization. And even though they sort of play coy and pretend that maybe yes, maybe no, they are both euphoric. I've read their diaries, I've read their correspondence. And Weizmann famously says that we would have to accept a Jewish state even if it were the size of a tablecloth. And predictably, the Mufti rejects the plan out of hand. And the British commissioners go back to England, and the revolt flares up again anew because it had been kind of put on hold for the duration of this commission. So it's at that point that the commission flares up again that the British kind of take the gloves off, and the Mufti becomes a wanted man. And that's really when the British start quashing the revolt in a very heavy-handed, even brutal way around late 1937-38.
One of the most fascinating characters in your book is this character, Ord Wingate. What role is he playing around this time?
Well, he really plays... Ord Wingate was a massively eccentric man, a British army officer. He was raised in a fundamentalist Christian home. Today, we would probably call them evangelicals. And he, unlike the vast majority of his comrades in the British Army and in the British administration in Palestine, was a fervent Zionist. He was also an Arabist. This is often forgotten, but his Arabic was far better than his Hebrew. He spent many years studying Arabic, and he was actually related to Lawrence of Arabia, but I digress. And Ord Wingate was, as I mentioned, extremely eccentric. He had a habit of eating onions like apples and welcoming guests in the nude, sometimes crunching on an onion. And he really, getting back to this idea of the birth of a Jewish army, he creates something called the Special Night Squads, which are mixed British Jewish units that operate at night and really take the fight to the enemy. They take the fight to these Arab armed groups. And in doing so, he really creates the first kind of Jewish special forces, if you like. These men get tremendous training from what is still the preeminent military in the world at this point. And he really creates the seed of the IDF officer corps, because these units include men like Moshe Dayan and Yigal Alon, who would go on to lead the IDF and to be ministers of defense of the State of Israel. And he's just a remarkable character. And yeah, that was some of the most fun sections, pages to write of the book were the section on Ord Wingate. He's one of the most colorful and eccentric characters ever to appear on this stage.
So in this period, we get the military training by Great Britain of future IDF or of the Haganah, and we have the promise of the Peel Commission. How do we get from there to what all Zionists regard as the disaster of the White Paper?
Right. Well, this is the era of appeasement. These are the Chamberlain years. And appeasement is not just a word that was used by people like Churchill who opposed it. I mean, appeasement was essentially official government policy, and not just vis-a-vis Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, but in the Middle East as well. This is the term that they would use in cabinet meetings. They would talk about appeasing Arab and Muslim opinion. And they were particularly worried, the Chamberlain cabinet was, about the Muslims of India. This is, of course, pre-partition India. This includes what we now call Pakistan and Bangladesh with their large Muslim populations. And the government was very worried that if the Muslims of the empire were angry about Palestine, that they would cause problems for the war effort, because it was becoming clear to everyone except perhaps Chamberlain, who still held out hope of appeasing Hitler. It was abundantly clear that the world seemed to be heading towards another world war, that it was a question of when and not if. There would be conflict with Hitler. And so the British, with their insatiable lust for committees, commissions, and conferences, they called the Jews and the Arabs to St. James's Palace in London. And not just the Arabs of Palestine, by the way, but they call the representatives of a number of Arab states, and really kind of grant their imprimatur to treating the Palestine problem as a matter for the entire Arab world, not just as it had been for the entire Jewish world. So basically, and they call these Arab and Jewish representatives together, and they meet for several weeks, but the result of this conference is kind of a foregone conclusion, because it's very clear that the British intend to significantly roll back their commitments to Zionism. And I mentioned the immigration spike of the early 1930s. Well, in 1935, 60,000 Jews came to mandate Palestine. That was double the figure of 2 years prior. So at the end of this conference, the upshot of it is this infamous white paper that you mentioned, which limits Jewish immigration to 75,000 total over 5 years. So from 60,000 a year to 75,000 total over 5 years.
Over what would be essentially the period of World War II?
Correct. This is issued in May, June 1939, a critical time for the Jews of Europe, of course. And that's kind of the upper cap that this white paper allows, after which any further Jewish immigration would be contingent upon Arab consent. And of course, everybody knew that consent would not be forthcoming. So this was really a reneging, not just on this Peel partition plan and this offer, this proposal of a Jewish state, but really a reneging on the Balfour Declaration itself. It's really the British saying, okay, the Jewish national home has been created, we've done our part, and that's that. And it basically calls for, it doesn't say an independent Arab state, but everyone, again, it doesn't require much imagination to recognize that if the Jews are kept below 40% of the population indefinitely, permanently, that is de facto an Arab state. And so it's seen as a tremendous betrayal by the Jews. It's seen as a huge victory for the Arabs. And really, it's the one clear, unassailable achievement that the Arab revolt leaves the Arabs with. And yet it still wasn't good enough for Haj Amin. The Mufti rejects the white paper for not going far enough. I think this is also often forgotten, that although there were demonstrations in the streets celebrating this white paper, the streets of Nablus and Nazareth, the Mufti could not grant his approval because for him, 75,000 Jews more was simply too many. It was 75,000 too many. So, yeah.
Another moment that one might say foreshadows future events. How do Ben-Gurion and Weizmann respond to the debacle of the white paper?
Well, I think they're heartbroken. I think, you know, there's a scene in my book which I'll try not to spoil for anyone who hasn't read it. But there's a Zionist Congress called in August 1939, and it's just some of the most moving scenes among the research that I did for this book. Some of the most moving scenes that I was reading about was really this Zionist Congress in August 1939, when really the walls are closing in on the Jews, and they don't know the enormity of what's about to come, but they know there's this sense of dread where you have World War on one hand, you have a World War with Hitler on the doorstep. On the other hand, you have the white paper in Palestine. It's also at this time that the Nazis and the Soviets sign a non-aggression pact, and so it's really it's fairly heartbreaking. Also, just to read when you read Weizmann's testimony, for example, to this conference in May 1939, he keeps mentioning the figure of 6 million. He's banging on the table. It's really uncanny. He's banging on the table saying 6 million Jews need a home. 6 million, 6 million. And of course, a few months later, the war starts.
Wow. So
I feel like we need to insert some more uplifting content here, Abe. We're gonna, things are difficult enough without...
Well, it is the 9 days, but let's step back for a moment. I don't know if it'll be any cheerier, but you spent the years researching and writing this book, working in archival materials in English, Hebrew, and Arabic. It's a terrific book, and compulsively readable despite the topic or you know the history. Do you feel like it gives you insight into the present moment? If that was the beginning of the Arab-Israeli conflict as we presently know it, we're certainly living through right now another spike, another high point or low point. Obviously, history does not give straightforward morals. One can't just say, well, this happened in 1937, so now I know what's going to happen in 2025. But how do you approach present events with all this history in mind?
Well, I think perhaps there are two ways to answer that. On the one hand, there was a critical mass of Arab Palestine that even before there was a state of Israel and before there was a single Palestinian refugee, simply refused to countenance the idea of Jewish self-determination in any form, or even significant Jewish immigration in any form. That's not exactly fodder for optimism. But on the other hand, you know, there's even when we look at the Peel Commission plan, for example, it's true that the Mufti rejected it out of hand, but there were actually quite a few prominent Arab leaders who agreed to the plan. It doesn't mean they were Zionists. It means that they recognized the Jews weren't going anywhere, that they had established a foothold, that perhaps even some of their claims were somewhat legitimate. And I think, you know, one of the kind of tantalizing / depressing elements of this period is all of the kind of what if moments. What if the British had appointed somebody else to be Grand Mufti? The main opposition camp to the Husseinis in this period are the Nashashibis. It's another prominent Jerusalem family and their allies. And for example, the Nashashibis accepted the two-state solution, which, by the way, would have granted the Jews a much smaller state than the UN offered in 1947, let alone the State of Israel today. It would have meant an international Jerusalem, and it would have meant a diminutive Jewish state along the coast and in the Galilee. And so, you know, there's, I think, one of the characters who readers really connect with in my book is a man named Musa Alami, we probably don't have time to get into him deeply, but he's a brilliant man and a very sympathetic character in many ways. And one wonders, okay, what if the British had appointed someone like that? And so, you know, what if the British hadn't passed the white paper in 1939? How many lives could have been saved? And so there are so many of these what if moments.
How many lives do you think could have been saved? Some, you know, I know, was it Ben Gurion who thought maybe it could be millions, or but how many in your estimation?
I don't think it's an exact science, but I think it was Golda Meir who made the more modest estimate of several hundred thousand, and I think that's probably more plausible. I don't know if Palestine of that period, let alone the small portion of the land of Israel that was offered to the Jews, could have absorbed millions of people in that period, and I don't think the Jews of Europe were sufficiently aware of the enormity of what was to come.
How much was the Yishuv able to circumvent it? I mean, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Ben-Gurion says, we'll fight the war against Hitler as if there were no white paper, and fight the war against the white paper as if there were no Hitler, something like that. So are they successful in fighting the war? How many Jews come anyway, despite the restrictions?
I'm not sure that there are reliable statistics on that, because, of course, it's illegal immigration at the end of the day. The numbers that I've seen, I mean, it was a relative trickle in the war years. My own grandfather came in 1944, came here from Romania, and there were only 4,000 or 5,000 Jews who, at least according to the statistics that we have, that came in that year.
Maybe we'll in this way, I don't want to give away the whole book. People should read it. But you mentioned Musa Alami, who's a Cambridge-trained lawyer, Cambridge University, as the kind of counterweight or alternative possibility to the Grand Mufti. You tell an interesting kind of poignant story of his several meetings with Ben-Gurion. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about that and the what if that's sort of hovering over those meetings.
Well, Alami was, as you mentioned, he was a Cambridge man. He was probably the first Arab from Palestine to attend Cambridge. He was a brilliant man by most accounts, and he was an Arab nationalist, full stop. But he had relationships, friendships, across ethnic and religious lines among the British and indeed among the Jews. And one of those relationships was with none other than Ben-Gurion. And they would meet starting in, I believe, 1933-34, fairly regularly, sometimes in Jerusalem or in Alami's village near Jericho, his summer house. And they meet in an atmosphere of tremendous mutual respect and even warmth, despite their diametrically opposed political aspirations. And they really try to reach a modus vivendi. I try to use that relationship as a kind of through line to the book, because that relationship really remains intact in one way or another until the 1970s, until Ben-Gurion dies in December 1973. And there's actually some fascinating meetings that they have after the 1967 war, in which Ben-Gurion, as soon as Israel just achieves this astounding victory in 1967, the only person Ben-Gurion wants to talk to is Musa Alami. And he has his people track him down in London, and he flies out to London, and they meet, and they sort of brainstorm and talk, and I won't spoil it. But it's just a fascinating, I think, one of the things I was most happy about being able to do in this book is to kind of rescue Musa Alami from semi-obscurity. I really thought he was ripe for the plucking from semi-obscurity, because he's an example of what leadership and humanity might look like on that side of the ledger, which, by the way, is not to suggest that he was a peacenik. I think, you know, readers of this book will see that he was not above using.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah. Ben-Gurion and others would have been surprised by some of his actions and support.
Exactly, but you know who else wasn't a peacenik? Ben-Gurion and Weizmann were far from that as well, particularly Ben-Gurion. And so, you know, these are complex individuals, but it was a real pleasure, real joy getting to know these characters.
Well, it's a terrific read, an important book, and I do urge everybody to read it. Well, we should do this again, even before the next book. Warren Kessler, thanks so much. Thanks for coming on the pod.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Warren Kessler for coming on. The JRB podcast is a production of the Jewish Review of Books and was produced by Akiva Schick. You can subscribe to our podcast via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube Podcasts. Meanwhile, keep reading.